This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. With a major healthcare debate now possibly taking shape, we have done a number of shows recently on various health reform approaches. Last year, we organized a series with the National Governors Association on the elements of state health initiatives. And this year, we've looked at the idea of requiring individuals to purchase coverage, as well as proposals to provide tax-based subsidies for private health insurance. Today, we tackle one strategy for actually delivering coverage, allowing the uninsured and others to enroll in a public plan, much like Medicare. This public plan would, in effect, compete side by side with private insurers. To its proponents, this is a way to guarantee universal coverage in a way that lowers healthcare expenses and administrative costs. To its critics, it's too intrusive a role for government and would stifle innovation. And to some proponents and critics alike, it could eventually lead to what is in effect a single-payer health system. We have three experts in the studio here today to wrestle with this idea, how it would work, and what it would mean. Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science at Yale and the author of Healthcare for America Plan, which includes a public plan option. Linda Blumberg is a principal research associate at the Urban Institute and is one of the nation's experts in modeling the effects of health system reform plans. And Stuart Butler is vice president for domestic and economic policy at the Heritage Foundation. He has written about just about everything, but most recently on the cost of entitlements as well as state-based health reform. You can reach our panel of experts at any time during the show by emailing your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org. We'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Jacob, let's start with you. You have a proposal that includes this idea of a public plan option for the uninsured and others to enroll in. Give us kind of the two-minute version of what you propose.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me on, Larry, and I'm pleased to join Linda and Stuart to talk about this. I think this is a really important part of the reform debate that hasn't gotten enough attention yet. So my proposal, and indeed both of the leading Democratic candidates' proposals, include the option of enrolling in a public health insurance plan modeled after Medicare for those who don't have secure workplace coverage. So this is in some ways similar to the way the current Medicare system works, in the sense that you could have a public insurance plan that would offer you a guaranteed benefit package, that would give you free choice of doctors, that would be predictable and affordable, or you could enroll in a choice of private plans that would offer similar level of benefits for a different premium. And the basic idea here is that it's a good thing to have choice and competition. Private insurance has a lot of virtues, but we know that it's been growing, its costs have been growing very quickly, that it hasn't always been guaranteeing affordability and security for Americans. And our public insurance programs like Medicare are quite popular. They've done a very good job at keeping costs under control relative to private insurance. And if they had more Americans in them, they could do a better job in the future. So letting people have a choice, making sure that they have a guaranteed option that's simple, that's affordable, that provides them with the choice of doctors, seems to me a no-brainer.
And what you mentioned, keeping costs under control, what would be the levers that the public plan would have to do that?
Well, just starting off, the public plan would have a huge amount of administrative efficiencies. There's dispute over the exact level of administrative costs, but no one disputes that Medicare's administrative costs are quite a bit lower than private insurer administrative costs. The other thing that Medicare can do and has done very well in recent years is it can start to explore the cost of alternative treatment options. It can look at quality questions. Medicare has really been investing in this infrastructure, and it makes sense for a large public insurer to do that. The one public system that's really done this is the VA system, and it's had real success in both keeping costs down and ensuring that VA people get the care they need. The third thing that Medicare can do is bargain. It's a big purchaser of care, so it can go to the drug companies, it can go to the doctors and hospitals and say, give me a good deal. And in fact, that's one of the reasons Medicare's costs have grown slightly slower than private insurance costs, is because it's able to do that. But I think the important thing to think about is not so much exactly how would Medicare control cost or how would a new public insurance plan control cost, but what would it be offering to people? And what it would be offering is guaranteed benefits. It says, look, here are the benefits, here's the premium, it's like Social Security, it's like Medicare, it's simple, it's understandable, and it's guaranteed.
And who would, I mean, you talked about people without workplace coverage being able to enroll in this. How would workplace coverage itself interact with this plan or the system?
So what I envision and what the candidates envision is a system in which employers, if they continue to provide coverage, nothing really changes. They just have to meet certain minimum standards. They have to provide coverage that offers good basic benefits. But if employers don't provide coverage, then they have to help contribute to the cost of either of allowing their workers to go into this new insurance pool where they can choose between public insurance or private plans. So really, the way that this works in practice is that it's that there are employer plans, and then there is the public insurance plan, and then there are private plans within this public insurance framework that people can choose if they don't want to enroll in the public insurance plan. So really, there's been some estimates done on my proposal. Really what we're talking about is a system in which there are millions of uninsured Americans who don't have coverage at all right now, and going from that to a system in which everyone has coverage, either from their employer from a public insurance plan or from private plans that cooperate with this public insurance plan.
And Linda, I mean, you spent a lot of time sort of thinking about modeling the effects of these kinds of plans. Help us think about how some of these choices would play out. It seems like there are a few choices. You know, one is employers choosing whether to offer coverage or pay into this pool. Individuals deciding whether to enroll in the public plan or private plans. What are some of the issues to think about in that?
Well, obviously, a lot of the impacts are going to depend on the details of how the policies are laid out. We don't know a lot about what the presidential candidate's details are going to be, and Jacob laid his out in kind of a general manner. But just speaking of it in kind of an overview way, that if you have, part of it depends on what kind of benefits that you're offering in the public plan, how that compares to the private plans. I think in general, what we see when we model these kinds of approaches is that the really large employers, those that are self-insuring or have very large numbers of covered lives in the pools, end up staying for the most part doing what they're doing. There's a lot of inertia there. There's also a lot of administrative economies of scale that these large employers already have. They also have the ability to provide different kinds of networks of providers that the workers often find attractive. So we usually see those really large employers staying put and doing what they're going to be doing. There's other employers, those employers that are often already on the margin right now of making a decision to offer versus not offer, who we might see some advantages of the economies of scale in a large purchasing pool moving that direction instead. And then we have the individuals who obviously, if that's their only option, depending upon whether there's a mandate or not a mandate, you know, you get more or less of them going in purchasing in the pool. Once you have the situation with, you know, a public plan competing with the private plans, I think you see inside kind of a government-organized purchasing pool, you're also going to see splits there depending upon the variation in the benefits. Some people are going to be very willing to pay more money to stay in a private plan if they perceive that plan as being higher quality, giving them a broader network or richer benefit packages. And so it really, how those pieces split up once they're inside that purchasing pool is going to depend upon the perception of the plans and the benefits that are offered in the different spots.
And as you said, the details here matter a lot.
The details always matter a lot. And so we can actually structure it to work more or less the way that we want it to by making those choices. You know, if we want to have really a level playing field, we make sure that the benefit packages in the public fee-for-service plan are identical to the ones that are in the private plans. A lot of people like the choice of having supplemental benefits, et cetera, in the private, and so, you know, you can kind of design it the way you want it for the outcome that you're striving for.
And Stuart, let me bring you in. I mean, first, what's your reaction to this kind of approach?
Well, certainly the objective, one's trying to do under this kind of approach, I think we all share. There are millions of people who can't get coverage because of their medical condition and other reasons. There are others that have got inadequate coverage, uncertain coverage. So the idea of having some way in which everybody can find some alternative to going through the traditional system, I totally agree with. And indeed, I've supported the idea of allowing states to experiment with even probably more sweeping approaches than actually Jacob suggested in terms of having maybe even Medicare for all in certain states. So that idea of doing it, I think, is very laudable. I think it's also very laudable to have competition and comparison so that we can see what's working better. But that said, it's important, I think, also, I guess, as already been mentioned by Linda, that it's very important to kind of look at how the competition is taking place. And in particular, one concern would be, is one group or one part of the competitive system being in some way subsidized or in some way getting being made more attractive than the others and therefore not having true competition. Let's remember that even within Medicare today, there's a big debate going on, and some people are arguing that the private plans in Medicare are getting an unfair subsidy, so they're not, it's not real fair competition. Well, clearly there's going to be the same question about a Medicare program running in balance with, in competition with other private plans. So that's an issue. I think it's an issue about whether there's a long-term stability to Medicare as a way of generally covering people. Yes, its overhead costs may be low, but on the other hand, there are very large subsidies in the Medicare system in Part D and Part B. The long-term picture for Medicare is not very great in terms of its financing, so we've got that to bear in mind. And then I would say, thirdly, that I think most of the proposals that I'm aware of on the Democratic side, say Senator Obama's proposal, I think wisely actually envisions some kind of insurance exchange generally operating. He wants it at the national level. I favor it more at the state level. But then you've got the question of if you've got an exchange setting the rules and the requirements, and that's run by the government, and also the government is running one of the competing plans, competing programs, Medicare, you have to worry about if the people setting the rules are some of the same people involved in the competition. You know, if the referee in a game actually works for one of the teams, you've got to wonder whether the score is going to come out in a fair way. And so I think that's another issue that has really got to be considered very carefully in any of these kinds of designs. But I think generally this sort of the idea of allowing some element of the public sector kind of in a balanced level playing field, I think is something that ought to be tried, and it will keep everybody on their toes if it's done right.
So you think there's sort of an argument for this idea of kind of organizing competition, let's say like the federal employees plan, which is often used as an analogy. Mm-hmm. You're just unsure of the sort of introducing a public plan from right. sponsored by the government into that mix?
I think there has to be some mechanism, some framework for setting the rules and the objectives and also dealing with adverse selection, with costs and so on. And I think we probably all agree in some way that we've got to go in that direction. I think that's almost orthodox thinking now, to be honest. How you do it, at what level you do it, I think that we don't know enough to say we should have one structure nationally. I think we ought to be experimenting. We may even drift towards one structure. But I think some kind of exchange, the federal employee system, which I've long thought of as being an interesting model to at least amend and use, works, as you know, in that way.
Jacob, what about this idea of a national model versus different approaches state by state?
Well, I mean, I first should say that I think that Stuart and I are in agreement on a lot, which worries me, perhaps. I think it's great.
It may worry him as well.
Yeah. But in fact, I want to just make one quick point so there's not confusion here. That is, the proposal that I've outlined, and my assumption is that in both the Obama and Clinton proposals as well, which have not been nearly as fully specified, this new public insurance plan would not be Medicare. It would be a Medicare-like plan, one that would have broader benefits that were more appropriate to younger Americans and that would be separate from the Medicare system. And the idea would be that some of the best elements of the Medicare system could be incorporated into this public insurance option, but that it would nonetheless also be more directed towards younger Americans, be more attractive to younger Americans. And that really gets to some of Linda's points about, you know, what do people want, what kind of benefits would they like. And one thing I would say about what Americans want is that when you survey Americans, first of all, those in Medicare love it, and when you survey Americans about what kinds of reform options they want, they tend to divide fairly evenly, and there's a significant either plurality or sometimes majority that says that they would like to have a universal Medicare-like plan. So, and this is not what I'm proposing. I'm proposing that be a choice. So in terms of the way in which you would structure the choice of public and private insurance, I agree with both Stuart and Linda. It's very, very important. The playing field has to be level. As Stuart noted, it's not level now. We subsidize the private insurance plans within the Medicare system. And that's been a big debate. I think the best way to ensure that it would be level would be to have a twofold structure. There would be a public insurance plan that would be offered in the mix of competitive options, and then there would be some kind of oversight board that would be in charge of overseeing that competition that would be separate from it. With regard to whether it's state or federal, my view is that if we have to do it at the state level, if that's the way we have to build momentum, if states are going to move ahead and the federal government isn't, then by all means, I am with Stuart in terms of trying to push state reform. But this is really a national problem, and I don't think it can be effectively addressed on a state-by-state basis for a whole host of reasons. Right now, the states are under serious financial pressure. They face special restrictions due to federal law. And it's the case that there are many people who are going to live in states where there isn't effective action taken. So I see this as a national problem that requires a national solution, and then I think it would be the simplest and most straightforward option to make a system in which people had a menu of options that was regionally specific, depending on where they lived, but where the federal government was in charge of making sure that people and employers knew what the options were and how they signed up for it.
Well, all of you mentioned sort of this issue of risk selection or adverse selection among the plans, and we got a number of email questions about that as well. So. Want to get to those, and I'll read one of them to start. How would a publicly sponsored plan, which operates alongside private health insurance plans, avoid being a dumping ground for the private plans? Should private plans be subject to regulations covering guaranteed issue, renewal, limits on pre-existing condition exclusions, age gender-related rating bans, et cetera? Another similar question, since it is likely that more high-cost individuals would select the public plan, driving premiums up, would a mechanism be in place, such as a risk pool transfers or an additional infusion of public funds, to ensure that the premiums of the public plan would remain affordable? And Jacob, first maybe describe what you envision about sort of the terms of this competition, both kind of within this kind of public pool you've described, as well as between the public pool and the outside market.
Yeah. Well, so those are both potential sources of adverse selection. And you know, just to clarify for those who may not know, adverse selection is when less healthy people are most likely to sign up for coverage. And in fact, it makes perfect sense, right? It's a market-based response. And the way you deal with adverse selection in the market, it can be variable. And the way we've dealt with it in our society is we have programs that are covering disadvantaged populations, but there are millions of Americans who end up falling through the cracks and can't get coverage in the individual market because they're sick. And no one believes, and Stuart certainly doesn't believe, that we can leave the market to cover those people who are least capable of getting insurance on their own in the private market. So how do you deal with this problem? And so there's two sources of adverse selection that one would worry about. One is at the level of employer's choice, right? So do employers provide coverage, or do they enroll their workers in this new national framework in my proposal where they can choose public or private insurance? That turns out not to be as big of an issue as some have worried about. The Lewin Group, a blue chip consulting firm on healthcare, did estimates on my proposal, and what they found is that because the main determinant of whether a firm will sign up for the public insurance pool is their wage level and the amount that they would spend for premiums because of their size. Small firms pay a lot more. That it would mostly be a pretty even mix of patients that would be going into this broader pool
in
terms of their health. So the real issue is, and this gets back to what both Linda and Stuart were talking about, the real issue is how do you construct a level playing field? You don't want either the public plan or the private plans to gain advantage by selecting healthier people. And that's, in fact, one of the main reasons why it's alleged the Medicare Advantage plans have had a big advantage with the private plans within Medicare, have a big advantage is that they're selecting healthier people. So it seems to me that there are sort of before the fact and after the fact responses. Very quickly, on the before the fact responses, you just have to have regulations. The base benefit packages have to be similar. There has to be requirements of that everyone who wants to enroll can enroll. There has to be some regulations that prevent selective marketing and selective disenrollment of people. And on the backside, it seems to me that we also could think creatively about ways in which, on the front side, also the payments to the plans, which is true under the Medicare system now, we need to move more and more towards making sure those are tied to the potential cost of the individual subscribers.
This is the payment
from the government to the private plans, and of course the payment, the way in which the whole structure of choices with the public plan as well. So there has to be what's called risk adjustment. And then on the backside, I think you have to look to see whether or not certain plans are getting a less or more healthy mix. And you probably have to build into any structure a certain amount of money that's set aside that would be designed to basically reinsure plans, protect them against these unexpected high costs. But the truth is that the vast majority of people end up not needing a whole lot of care in any given year. It's a small pool that are really the high-cost patients, and that's certainly true within Medicare and in the private insurance market today. So it really seems to me that the important thing will be making sure that you have some protections against plans that end up with the very high-cost cases, and that could be done in really retrospectively after the fact.
And just to clarify, you mentioned risk-adjusted payments from the government to the plans based
right.
on the,
right.
the risk of their enrollees. The enrollees themselves would pay community-rated premiums regardless of their health status?
My vision is that the plans would have to, the private plans would have to offer a basic package of benefits, but they could offer additional benefits. I am wary of the idea that there would be a lot of price competition on premiums between the plan, the public plan, and the private plans, and I'm sure this will be a subject of dispute and disagreement. But the important point I think that needs to be emphasized is that there should be compensation for either the public plan or the individual private plans if they end up having an unhealthier mix of patients than is factored into what they're getting.
Linda, do you agree there's sort of ways to manage the risk as Jacob describes? I mean, is this kind of a manageable problem?
I think it depends on a couple of factors. I think, number one, if everybody's in the system, if you've got a mandate and everyone's covered, it's a lot easier to manage this problem than if you have people moving in and out, because people will tend to move in and out based on their expected health care expenses. And so it's always easier to handle the selection problem if you've got the whole pot to work with. Then you've got the issue of the variation in benefits. In Jacob's plan, everyone has the same core benefits, and then they price separately supplementals, right? But if you look at FEHBP as an example,
that's federal employees.
The federal employees health benefits plan, that Stuart was talking about a few minutes ago. There's quite a bit of variation in that plan on the benefit packages, and people have a contribution from their employer, the federal government, and they can pick what they want, but they may have to pay more for a richer benefit package. Americans tend to like a lot of variety. In insurance, I don't think that a lot of variety and choice is necessarily a good thing because of the selection problems it brings, but that doesn't mean that, you know, my vision of the world is the one that's going to be legislated. So my feeling is that if you're going to have a situation politically where you have to have more variety in packages that are being offered in the public plan and outside the public pool, that the first thing is, how much are you going to let it vary? Because if you've got real extreme variation in actuarial value of these plans, it's much harder to do the moving around of money across plans to make it work. If they're relatively close but with some variation, you can still make it work. So the closer they are, the easier it is to do. And so we want to not get too extreme about the choices that we're providing. And then I have to say, I have unending faith in the private insurance industry to figure out ways to select risks that are advantageous for them, even in the presence of regulations that we think are very clever and very protective. So I don't have a tremendous amount of confidence that the regulations alone are going to work, and that given that I predict that whatever system we put in place would have a variety of plans available in it, I believe we probably will need at the end of the day, particularly if it's not a mandate situation, that we'll need some other funds, some other publicly raised funds to subsidize basically the high-cost individuals. The key from my perspective is that the premiums that individuals face should not be directly related to the expected costs of the pool enrolling in a particular plan. The premium that individuals should face should be similar to what they would face if everybody in the population were enrolled in that plan. And so if that requires subsidization and a broad-based revenue source in order to even that problem out, then I think we'd have to go there. And I expect that that it's pretty clear we would without a mandate. And it may very well be that we need something like that, but of a smaller magnitude, even in the presence of a mandate with a lot of competing plans.
Now, Stuart, I mean, both Jacob and Linda sort of envision, if I could put words in their mouth, a fairly regimented competition.
It does sound like it.
Yeah. You talked about sort of you would support the idea of some kind of insurance exchange. How do you envision the competition working this way, or
I think
different?
I was actually amused to hear Jacob saying a number of times, "Well, we'll just have regulations take care of that." And as Linda said, this becomes more and more complex and more invasive the more you start trying to fix each of the problems. I would just make two points with regard to that. The first is that actually, as the person sending the email pointed out, there are a whole range of ideas proposals about how to deal with adverse selection. And each one has a certain number of votes for it, in a sense of among experts and so on. So that, to me, implies that one's got to move forward to try to deal with this by trying to do it on a more experimental basis, trying things out in different places. That's one of the reasons that I'm drawn very heavily towards the idea of systematically trying to address these sorts of issues at the state level. And Jacobs conceded that, all else failing, he would go along with that. I'm glad to hear that. But I think another thing I would just point out, particularly when you're talking about Medicare, is that it's very important to really nail down exactly what we mean by that precisely, because, of course, Medicare's benefits and basic design is set by the United States Congress. And one of the things we've always noticed about Medicare is how there's often gaps that take years to deal with, drug benefits, catastrophic coverage now, and so on. It makes the benefit structure rather inflexible compared with what other approaches use. The federal program, for instance, uses a negotiated, as Linda said, there's variations and so on. So I think it's very important to understand kind of what we mean. In terms of how we set an overall framework to kind of make this happen, as I said, I think an absolute priority is that whoever is doing that does not have a stake in the outcome of the public program versus the private program. And I think there's a lot of fear that whoever sets these rules is going to set rules and start changing the private sector, either to essentially make it less and less attractive over time, or to make it simply a clone of what the public program is. Now, you may be in favor of that or against it, but at least you've got to accept that that's a concern and suggest a way of avoiding that, if you want to avoid it.
And do you think there's a way to do that in terms of governance? I mean, can it be separate agencies of the government or a public-private?
I think you have to look at something like that. You know, it's not easy, and the way our political system works, it's very difficult to insulate one agency from another. But I certainly think that we've got to start exploring how to do that. We've got different levels of government, too, we can use in that mix. But I think it's very, very important. If you're going to get people to accept this and to think that it's not, in fact, going to lead to a big change in something they already find attractive. I mean, one of the things about Hillary Clinton's plan that she said right at the very beginning is, if you're satisfied with what you have, this isn't going to change it for you. Well, that's got to be a real commitment. And if you're going to have some kind of agency setting up a public plan and regulating everybody else and setting benefits and putting requirements, that's not really going to be true over time. So it's a difficult challenge to get this to work right.
And do you think, you talked about sort of experimenting at the state level? Would you be in favor of giving states quite a bit of leeway? I mean, for example, a state implementing something like Jacob has talked
absolutely
about.
Absolutely, I said at the beginning, I absolutely would, providing that it's done in a way where the real objectives and the real structure are laid out in advance and agreed. I'm also in favor of changes in federal law to permit things to be done at the state level that can't be done today, like a broader Medicare program or some other type of approach. I think that's very good. And you've got to have true comparison. You've got to have real measurement about what's actually going on and so we can evaluate it in a realistic way. I'm in favor of that. And if it turns out that Jacob's right and that we can and should set up a Medicare program that is better for everybody and works and so on, count me in. I'm skeptical, but count me in I could agree with that if I could see it being compared with something else.
And even this kind of mixed approach, I mean, requiring employers to participate?
Well, I think when you say requiring employers to participate, I'm no big fan of the employment-based system over the long haul, so let me just make that clear. Certainly, the way in which employers are involved in a program like this has got to be clearly understood. In any exchange program, you've got to make a decision about whether employers go into some program on a voluntary basis or are they required to do that. That's a threshold decision. You've got to make a decision about whether employees as individuals can go into something, whether or not their employer does. That's another threshold decision. These are the kinds of things you've got to experiment with and make some decisions based on, in very many cases, the values of the particular region or state that you're trying to do this in.
Well, I've gotten a lot of questions about sort of the relationship between this approach and a single-payer approach and the kind of governance issues that Stuart raised in terms of the public plan versus the private plan. So let's pursue that a little bit. I mean, first, let me ask all of you, I mean, do you, if we implemented something like Jacob has proposed, either at the federal level or at the state level? I mean, what's your best guess as to what the result of the competition would be? I mean, would this lead to the vast majority of people in the public plan, or would you expect a mix?
Well, the Lumen Group did do estimates of what the long-term trajectory would be, and their estimate was that over time more people would become enrolled in the broad insurance pool at the national level. But since a lot of people end up enrolling in private plans through this insurance pool, initially and over time, there still remains a very large private insurance market. Increasingly, though, I would expect that employers are going to pull back from directly providing insurance, except for, as Linda suggested, larger employers that have great economies of scale and have high-wage workforces and really value the goodwill that employee benefits provide. And if that's the case, and I think that's inevitable, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with Clinton that we should not disrupt the existing system too much. I think that's been the real bane of past reform efforts. The fact is the existing system is moving inexorably in a direction where fewer and fewer people have coverage through their employer. So I think that's going to continue. And I think that we'll move toward a system in which people are getting public and private coverage through a broad insurance pool. And I just think that, and I also was very pleased to see that that Stewart said that he would be, you know, he would sign up for a Medicare for All plan at the state level, or a plan like mine at the state level, if he thought it would work.
I'd move to another state.
Yes, exactly. I'm reminded of that Harry Truman was the first person enrolled in Medicare, so I will vow that Stewart will be the first person enrolled in health care for America. So I'll let this go to Linda, but at some point I would like to return to what I see as the real virtues of this public insurance option, why you would not want to have a system in which everyone is required just to have private insurance.
Let's come back to that. Linda, what's your sense of how this competition would shake out?
Well, I think, so I was mentioning before, it depends a lot about the details of what you're offering in the different places. But essentially, if you've got kind of a level playing field of benefits, or you've got some adjustment for risk that's real, I think that my prediction would be that we would maintain part in these private plans and part in the public plan over time. And I'm agreeing that the large employers I'm expecting to stay out really for the long run. But for others coming in, particularly if we've got low-income subsidies in that purchasing pool, as Jacob would have in there, and that they are available regardless of which of these options you choose, I think you'd have a split. I mean, I think that there's the reason I like the idea of having a public plan, fee-for-service plan, running alongside of the private plans is I think both of these options have their downsides. And I think of them as potentially being checks on each other's downsides while bringing their positives in as availability. I worry, Stewart's not going to believe me saying this, but, you know, I worry that a public plan alone is going to be so concerned with holding down the rate of growth over time through holding down the rate of growth of provider payments, that we would run into issues of concern related to supply constraints and a lot of political disruption among the providers and their lack of support for that kind of reform, and that over time we just wouldn't have the supply to satisfy the demand for services that we have. The private plans, which have less interest and would have less controls, I would imagine, in terms of holding down those kinds of payment rates, are a little bit of an escape valve on that concern. I worry about just the private plans because right now what we've got in, you know, for the non-elderly population are private plans, and I don't believe we have a competitive marketplace. I think that they shadow price each other, and that we really don't have a great deal of information about when we try to negotiate with these plans, as some states are starting to try to do, what the real level of those premiums ought to be, what's reasonable. If you've got a public plan that you're running, then, you know, you've got that check. So I really do see, as long as the rules are remain consistent and the benefits are not distorted from one sector to the other, that I really do see a maintenance over time within the pool of the private contracting plans and the public plans. And the public plans, you know, are also a fail-safe for the high-cost population, and that they know that they can get comprehensive benefits, you know, regardless of where they live, and can access the providers that they need when they need a lot of services. So I think those concerns balance each other out, and I would expect to see maintenance of that competition over time, if done correctly.
And Stewart, I mean, Linda talked about sort of not feeling like there is, you know, really a competitive marketplace among private plans now, and
that's true.
And
mm-hmm.
You'd agree with that.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't think that the structure that Jacob lays out, quite frankly, would be if you like, stable over time. I believe that it would evolve. I believe there would be continuing what I might call mission creep by the agencies that are doing this, because when you have the United States government, the federal government, becoming more and more involved, as it would do, in the organization and structure of plans right down through the state level into the private sector, when it has an interest in one of the competing parts of that program, the Medicare program, when that's the case, when it gets increasingly concerned about adverse selection and other things and starts to begin to regulate benefits elsewhere to try to make sure that this is a stable, I think slowly and steadily you begin to move towards much more of a regulated system where all parts of the system start coming under that umbrella. And over time, it becomes essentially a quasi sort of Medicare for all program. You may favor that. That's fine if you favor that. But I think that's inevitably what will happen. And I think it's particularly true if you try to do this from the national level, because I think that is where the difficulty of setting benefits when the United States Congress does that, trying to regulate something which is going to work the same in Manhattan as in rural Alaska, to try to get all this to work right, you become more and more intrusive. You have to be in order to do that. And that's why I think I would strongly recommend that if anybody goes down this direction, they do it from the bottom up rather than the top down. I think that is one of the big differences between Hillary Clinton's vision of the future of our healthcare system and other people's views. So I just think that for all the reasons that have been mentioned, that this isn't going to be a stable system. You're going to see continuous expansion of jurisdiction in order to try to keep on fixing, you know, problems that inevitably start coming up. It's not going to be a nice kind of balanced market of good ideas and public and private ventures. I just don't believe that's what's going to happen.
Well, Jacob, let's come back to some of these kind of governance issues. In your view, what's the fundamental case for the government playing this dual role? I mean, both sponsoring a plan as well as kind of organizing the marketplace, which I think all of you agree with.
Yes. Well, so again, I would agree with Stuart that these should be separate governance roles. And, you know, I grant that it's not easy to know exactly how you would set it up, but I think it can be done. And I think that one of the ideas that's come out of a lot of quarters about this debate is trying to think about some kind of benefit-setting oversight body that would be somewhat politically separate from the rest of government. There's no way to perfectly insulate any government agency from politics. That's an aspect of democracy and something that we should at least in part value. But there are ways in which to make it easier for people behaving in these functions to be able to operate independently. But I think the fundamental case really takes us back to some of the drawbacks of alternative approaches. So the leading approach that's been on the table since Massachusetts moved forward, when you've talked about with its individual mandate approach, has been to basically try to require that people enroll in private health insurance. It's a very much an individual insurance model with some kind of exchange that would be allowing people to buy that insurance. And there are real virtues of this approach, right? It is seen as being something that you can get business and insurance buy-in. It's something in which people who would want to have private insurance can see that as positive. But the real drawback is that there's not a real guarantee that you can offer a good package of benefits for a good price and over time keep the cost down. And, you know, the Lewin Group estimates of my proposal show that the premium for individual coverage within the public insurance plan would be quite a bit lower than the premium for coverage for the same package of benefits if provided by a private insurer. Why? Lower administrative cost, slightly lower payment rates, the ability to bargain for lower prices on drugs. And moreover, as I said before, I think there's a really important virtue here, right? We know that there is rampant underinsurance in the private insurance market, and there's a real fear, I think, that if we go down the route of requiring private insurance, we'll be chipping away at the benefits over time. You'll raise the deductible. We'll say, oh, this might not be covered. And this is a political decision to say we want to guarantee, as we do in Medicare, as we do in Social Security, we want to guarantee a fixed benefit. We want to guarantee something that can't be taken away, that's there for you, just a stable foundation of security.
And you, we had a lot of questions, and you talked about the payment rates, lower payment rates being one source of cost savings, and we got a number of questions about that. One was what the payment levels would be in this new national public plan, Medicaid, Medicare, commercial levels. Another was looking at other countries in the world who have achieved lower payments through both nonprofit insurance with low administrative costs and limiting payments to doctors. Mm-hmm. And would the AMA be likely to support that? I mean, what do you envision in terms of how these payment levels would be set and at what level they would end up being?
Well, I should say that I think that there are real problems in the way the Medicare payment levels now are set. In particular, I think that the rewards for primary care and basic care are too low relative to specialty care. But the way in which this would be structured is somewhat similar to the way the overall Medicare system works, in that the payment rates would be set through a process of negotiation, in which the government would be setting levels of compensation and prices based on relative amount of work, the amount of usually, I think, with hospitals, it would be done with diagnosis. With regard to physician payments, it might be done more with regard to the specific services that are delivered. There would have to be, I think, a great deal of emphasis on collecting information, on quality and comparative effectiveness, so that we could do this in a way that's better than we do it now. But what we do know about private insurance and public plan payments right now is that, first of all, the differences are not that great when you look beneath the surface, and that in many ways the public insurance plan, Medicare, has actually set the standard in many ways for the private insurance market in terms of doing technology assessment and deciding what to cover. So I think that we can often underestimate the extent to which Medicare also already plays an important leadership role. Now, I think that the important thing to remember is that that we would have a competitive framework in which people could choose, vote with their feet, if you will, between public and private insurance. And so if indeed over time, as Stuart fears and I perhaps am less concerned about, that people moved over into the public insurance side of this system, I think that that would reflect the consumer's demands for greater stability, security, the guaranteed coverage that's there. And there may be concerns over time about whether or not the payment levels are adequate, as Linda said, and that would be something that would have to be carefully monitored. But one thing I would emphasize is that all of these proposals would massively expand the range of people who are covered, and they would help providers immensely by making sure that they were compensated when they actually provided care.
And Stuart, you talked earlier about looking at the current Medicare system and private plans being subsidized under that system with recent laws. I mean, what are some of the lessons you see from the way Medicare works now, which in some sense is an analog with a public fee-for-service Medicare system and private Medicare?
There are a lot of lessons. I mean, whichever side you're on the debate about whether private plans are subsidized, over-subsidized or not, or whether it's a startup cost, as some people argue, and so on to get them going, the fact is that it's a political and legislative decision. And it's quite there was a political decision to subsidize and to encourage the growth of private plans. There could be a political decision to go in another direction. You just can't avoid the fact that when you look at so-called competition, if the government is running it and has an axe to grind in terms of what it wants the outcome to be, it can start skewing the competition in all kinds of ways, either one way or the other, depending on who's in control. Let's just realize that and accept that. I think a second thing to draw from the Medicare situation, as I said earlier, that you have a legislature, the United States Congress, that gets into the business of designing benefits. That has all kinds of problems, including the fact that in Medicare, much of the benefit structure is way behind in terms of, or it lags considerably what happens in terms of other kinds of new kinds of benefits in the private sector. And that's a feature. I think, as Jacob kind of hinted at, and I would support, the idea of trying to get that out of the legislature more into some kind of standing commission or something like that would make a lot of sense. And I'd say the third thing is that, when you look at the long-term situation in Medicare, you have a structurally unsound program. I spend a lot of my time going around the country with Dave Walker from the General Accountability Office and the Brookings Institution and so on, just trying to tell people that the scenario that we're looking forward in Medicare, in terms of the imbalance between the revenues that are coming in the future and the expenditures, So if we were to try to say that's going to be the benchmark for our entire system in the future, I shudder to think about what the imbalance will be, and that we will see, I think, in terms of the politics, we will see presidents and congressmen, as they do in Medicare, continue to say they want to add on benefits, resisting steps to regulate and to push down costs, which is exactly what we're seeing with Medicare, where every time there's an attempt to try to push down the expenditures on the providers, the AMA and its friends come to Capitol Hill and get it turned back or slow it down. And that's what worries me about the long-term financial picture if we go down this road.
Linda, I mean, as Stuart's talking about sort of and I think it's widely agreed that the Part A trust fund in Medicare, you know, will go insolvent at some point, potentially relatively soon. Sort of that fiscal imbalance that Stuart talks about in Medicare, I mean, how much of that is applicable, do you think, to what Jacob has proposed, or how much of the current Medicare experience is you know, in some sense, a different kind of structure?
Well, clearly, I think it's important if we're designing a very broad-based reform in healthcare that it be financed in a very sound way and that we continue to make decisions that keep it in financial balance. Stuart's right. That's very complicated to do sometimes when you've got all these competing interests and different stakeholders fighting against what you think may be a more responsible way to design a program. I don't think that we should look at the Medicare program and say, well, we've been, you know, just staying a few steps ahead of fiscal imbalance for a long time, and so we should just forget trying to take care of the low income and people with high medical needs as a consequence of our some modestly irresponsible fiscal behavior in the past. I mean, the truth is that the Medicare Trust Fund won't go out of balance because we will make changes in order to keep it in balance, or we'll have other reforms where we're melding the Medicare population in with a new program. I think that the issues of cost containment that need to be applied to Medicare are the same issues that we need to be thinking about with regard to a more broad-based reform. Are these easy choices? No, they're not. But right now what we're doing is not a good option either in terms of leaving, you know, in order to deal with our financing problem, leaving a big chunk of people out of the system entirely. So I think we need to look really hard at what's driving spending in healthcare in general, which we know is in large part the increasing intensity of medical care that people are consuming over time, some of it with significant value and a lot of it without significant value, and think about, you know, in terms of what we're going to cover and the decisions that we're going to make under a reform being a function of really what's cost effective. And, you know, while that may be a little bit more intrusive than people like, I think it's the only way to kind of sustain financial viability in a new reform and to get the situation of the financing of Medicare under control as well. But these are all the same lessons. These are all the same investment in what cost containment mechanisms, what management of high-cost cases, what evaluation of new technologies and procedures and existing technologies and procedures we should be making. And so I think they're all tied together. But I wouldn't sacrifice coverage for 47 million people and growing because we've had bad political behavior with regard to the Medicare program. I think it's time to get our financial house in order on both sides and make the kind of necessary investments we have to make to figure out how to have a sustainable growth path on medical spending into the future.
And Jacob, I mean, Linda talked about technology or intensity driving healthcare costs and also making decisions about what's valuable and what's not valuable in terms of treatment, and we had a couple questions about sort of how those decisions would get made in a system like this. I mean, talk about what you envision in terms of both the private plans and the public plan. How would these decisions about medical necessity be made? What kind of rules or regulation would govern that? And what would be the mechanism for the public plan as well? Would the public plan make them in the same way as the private plans? Who actually would be making those decisions?
Right. Well, let me just step back though, because this is very much related. The last question was asking about what we've learned from other countries, and also I wanted to just say a word that ties into that about Medicare's longer term cost record. You know, as worrisome as Medicare's long-term fiscal picture is, I think Linda rightly said, you know, this is really a system-wide problem. And in fact, you know, the numbers are clear that Medicare has done a little better than the private sector in keeping costs down. particularly since the mid-1980s, when it started to really exercise more effective control over costs. And when we look abroad, we find that that Medicare's cost control experience looks more like the experience of other countries that have, through widely different means, you know, sometimes they have quasi-public insurers that are operating, you know, sort of on a mutual fund basis, and sometimes they have single government programs on a widely different basis. They're nonetheless getting a better experience in terms of cost control over time. It's not great, but it's better. And what we can see in terms of the quality evidence is that the quality of the care in these other countries is quite good as well. And the important thing, I think, is that we are just beginning, I think, having a revolution in a way in terms of thinking about how we can ensure quality. So, and I am very much of the view that if we have a public insurance plan alongside private plans, that not only will we have competition over premiums, but we'll also start to have competition over quality. And that's really important. Now, my bias is to think that a public insurance plan that has a large number of patients, that has a responsibility to those patients in terms of community health, most of them are going to be in this program for much of their lives, because a lot of the people who are going to enroll in public insurance are going to want to stay in public insurance, that has the ability to collect information on a wide range of providers, to implement new protocols and practice guidelines, to do the kinds of things that we know need to be done to improve quality. It's going to have a better record in terms of getting good care to people, quality care to people at a good price. But the nice thing about competition is that we can find out whether that's true. The private insurance plans right now, they largely mimic Medicare's practice, and Medicare hasn't done nearly enough to try to do this. So the last thing I'd say, and I think this is really important, is that this is a separate program from Medicare. It's a separate option from Medicare. I think over time we might decide that we don't want to have a system in which the elderly are in a separate system. For example, I would take the existing state programs, Medicaid and the state children's health insurance program, and I'd put them into this pool, but that's not something that the candidates are supporting. I think over time we'd hopefully move towards a framework in which we had a much more cohesive integrated system, in which we were spending a lot more time worrying about whether or not we're getting the best value for a dollar, whether we're delivering quality care. And I think that the way to do that is to have a public insurance option competing with private plans. Private plans have followed Medicare in a lot of their decisions. There is not a lot of evidence that they have been spearheading quality improvement because, as Linda said, their incentives are really pretty clear. They can save lots of money by not insuring people who cost money. So in a new system, they'll have more incentive to focus on quality, I hope, but let's also have an auxiliary precaution, if you will, of having this new public insurance plan that's really charged with delivering high-quality care to its beneficiaries.
And how much leeway would you give these plans in terms of benefits, making medical necessity determinations, right, drug formularies, you know, which drugs to cover, et cetera?
You know, my view is that with regard to broad benefits, basic benefits, I think that there has to be a level playing field for a lot of the reasons that Linda said. I believe that there should be supplemental benefits. I believe that plans should be able to offer more for an additional premium. I also believe that within that broad, you cover these, you know, requirement, you cover these categories of benefits, and you have similar kind of, we like the term actuarial value, the similar overall value, that there should be a lot of discretion for the plans. Now, what really is important, though, and this gets back to Stuart and Linda's point about monitoring, is that we really try to pay attention to what's happening to patients. Because I think in Medicare today and in the private sector today, we're not following the long-term experience of patients as we should be. And that's, I think, the real value of thinking about this as a broad coverage, not, I have to say, not state by state, but at the national level, that we have the idea that everyone is in this together, that this is universal coverage, everyone has coverage, everyone is also in it together in the sense that we're worried about the quality of the care that every American is receiving. You know, John McCain gave a speech a couple days ago about his health plan, and he started off with something that I really totally agree with, which he said that just because you're not wealthy, it doesn't mean you shouldn't get access to good quality care. And we need to make a commitment to that value and that goal. I think we should do it through a different way than he does, but I think we need to make that commitment.
And Stuart, let me come back to you. I mean, we've talked a lot about this sort of state versus federal, I wanted to ask you, give you an opportunity to talk about sort of what are the range of approaches you think states could or should be trying. I mean, what you know, or how would you circumscribe? You know, what would you prohibit states from doing?
Well, first of all, let me just take off where Chair Gbenya did, and I also agree that as a nation, we should have and do have certain values and goals that we share. and that's true in healthcare, as it's true in education and a number of other areas. And I think that is and should be a national decision. It should be a decision that no matter how wealthy you are or how sick you are or how poor you are, that you can get access to what we as a nation feel is an adequate level. So that's agreed. So then it becomes an issue of how best to get there and what are the ramifications. So I think that's clear. Now, therefore, when I look at something like state innovation, I don't take the view you just let states do whatever they want and they can go 20 different directions or 50 different directions. What you say is there are certain broad objectives we have. There are certain parameters. There are certain things you can do to improve coverage, but it might not include having very sick people throw them off in order to bring a lot of healthy people in and say, I've increased coverage. There are certain very clear parameters. I think the United States, the federal government, should set those parameters. After that, I believe that the state should be able to come forward and say, we have a way of reaching this, which we think is plausible and can reach those goals in a better way. And it could be a Medicare for all. It could be something based on the federal employee program. It could be a VA type of arrangement. Or it could be a very market-based type of approach based on employers or on individuals. Let's see what they come up with, measure it, and see if they're successful. And if they are successful, let that be part of the national system in the future. We can have variety if we have shared goals and shared values.
And you think there's a necessity for federal money in that as well?
Well, I think clearly if you're going to reach some objectives that allow people in rural Mississippi to be able to have similar standards to people in the Upper East Side of New York City, then you've probably got to move money around. And that is part of the role of the federal government and the federal tax system, for that matter. And I think, you know, people recognize that. They're not getting away from that. But that's very different. Moving money around and setting broad goals, it's very different from coming in and micromanaging precisely what's done in every part of the country.
Well, we're approaching the end of the hour, and I want to give everyone a final question. There's been a lot of discussion about healthcare this week. Senator McCain has given a number of healthcare speeches. At the same time, there's a lot of talk about the faltering economy, and that's certainly been dominating the agenda on the campaign trail and in Congress. And I wanted to get each of your sense of what the implications of an economic downturn is for the healthcare debate. Does it make it more important? Does it make it more difficult to do the kind of things we've been talking about? You know, what are the linkages between what's going on in the economy and healthcare? Linda, give you the first opportunity.
I think it absolutely makes it more important and absolutely makes it more difficult. I mean, we're in a situation now where if we've got declining employment, that carries with it declining health insurance coverage. We know that with increasing unemployment, we have increasing uninsurance. We also have a situation where the prices are continuing to grow in medical care. So without insurance, access to getting necessary care becomes more and more difficult for individuals. And we have a situation where the talk is much more about tax rebates than it is about revenue raising. But I think that these issues are definitely ones that we have to think of not just as a point in time kind of decision to be making, but we need to be thinking about this as a counter-cyclical effort. When we have a recession or where we have a bad economic situation, that's when more money from the government has to be available to bring people back where they need to be to sustain their necessary health status. And when things are in good times, we should be raising more revenue to cover for the times that are not. And we don't tend to do that politically. We tend to want to be giving back money whenever we have the opportunity to give back money, and we're not great savers. And I think that this is a situation, along with many others, that increases it highlights how important it is for us to be squirreling away funds when times are good in order to take care of the country when times are not so good. But I definitely think this is the time to be talking about these issues and to making moves to correct the problems because people are sensitized to it. It's when their vulnerability to these cyclical problems is at their height. And people are open to thinking about big measures to protect themselves over their life cycle.
And Stuart, we've talked a lot about sort of state-based approaches. During a downturn, states that have to balance, which by law have to balance their budgets, it's not the most fortuitous of times for them to be experimenting.
But the federal government. Yeah.
Yeah. But what role do you see for the federal government in a time like this? And what do you think the general implications are for what's going on?
Well, I say the general implications are, I think, and our experience shows this very clearly over many, many years, that when economic times get more difficult, people do worry about health care. They worry about continuation and the cost of health care, and they want something. They're more inclined to want something done. On the other hand, when people are anxious and uncertain and worried, they tend to just want to have more help with what they currently have and not a big change. They don't want more worries, and they tend to be resistant, in fact, to big change. So, you know, it's one of these sort of dilemmas or dichotomies that at the same time as there's more concern about healthcare, people are, in fact, less inclined to see big disruption in what they already have, and that doesn't help innovative ideas to be really take hold. I think, you know, when you have difficult economic times, and particularly when that shows up in larger deficits at the federal level or the state level, it's always going to be more difficult to do something new, because when you do something new, people tend to want to have it on top of what they currently have. And let's see that first before we change what we currently have. And it just really makes all healthcare change and improvement actually a bit more difficult than it would be at another time. It's one of the ironies, I think, of the situation.
And Jacob, how about you? You get the last word here. What's your sense of what's going on in the economy means for an approach like you proposed?
Well, I do think it makes people much more concerned about their economic security, and I think this is a distinctive recession because it's the first on record. And granted, we're not in a recession yet. This is a distinctive economic downturn because it's the first time we've had a real threat of recession after a period in which middle-class incomes really haven't risen at all. And I think over the last generation, and particularly over the last 8 years, we've seen a real decline in the perceived economic security and actually economic security of Americans. And so I think that makes healthcare a kind of burning front and center issue in many Americans' minds, but it's tied up with so many other issues, whether their homes are secure, whether they can afford to pay for a college education, whether they'll have their job, whether they can save enough. And that crowds out sometimes consideration of healthcare. So what I would argue is that we need to see healthcare as part of a more general commitment to the idea that people need a basic foundation of economic security to succeed in a more dynamic economy, that they need to be able to have that security to be able to look to the future and reach for the American dream. And, you know, the one thing that I will say that I think is, you know, we all agree on is that the current system is not what we want, what Americans believe in or what we believe in. And so I think if that's the case, then it's incumbent upon everyone to try to look toward thinking about how we can improve this and provide security to all Americans.
Yeah, I don't think there's any advocate for the status quo on this panel. We'll have to leave it there. Larry Levitt, you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll see you next time for Ask the Experts.